This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy B. An Iranian intelligence officer and three members of an Iranian intelligence network have been charged in Manhattan with plotting to lure U.S. resident and human rights activists from New York to Iran. An indictment in Manhattan federal court Tuesday alleges that the plot was part of a wider plan to lure three individuals in Canada and a fifth person in the United States to Iran, United Kingdom to Iran. According to the indictment, all of the targeted victims had been critical of Iran. One defendant not charged in the kidnapping plot was arrested July 1st in California. A lawyer declined to comment. The rest are fugitives believed to be based in Iran. New COVID-19 cases per day in the United States have doubled over the past 3 weeks, driven by the fast-spreading Delta variant, lagging vaccination rates, and 4th of July gatherings. Infections jumped to an average of about 23,600 a day on Monday. That's up from 11,300 on June 23rd. In all but two states, Maine and South Dakota, reported the case numbers have risen over the past 2 weeks. Some parts of the country are running up against deep vaccine resistance. South Africa's police say that at least 72 people have been killed and 1,234 have been arrested in unrest set off by the imprisonment last week of former President Jacob Zuma. In a statement issued Tuesday night, Police Major General says many of the deaths were caused by stampedes when shops were being looted. He said 27 deaths are being investigated in Gauteng province. In addition to the people crushed, he says that police are investigating deaths that appear to be caused by explosions when people tried to break into ATM machines. This is VOA News. The death toll from a fire at a hospital coronavirus ward in Iraq has climbed to at least 92. The Iraqi state news agency made the announcement Tuesday as Angwart's family members buried their loved ones and lashed out at the government over the tragedy. The blaze that erupted Monday in the city of Nasiriyah was the second catastrophic fire in less than 3 months to kill hospitalized COVID-19 patients in Iraq. The death toll in the collapse of a hotel in eastern China has risen to at least 17 as authorities called an end to the search and rescue mission. The city of Suzhou said that 23 people have been pulled alive from the rubble of the hotel, which collapsed on Tuesday afternoon. The rescuers used cranes, ladders, metal cutters, and search dogs to look for survivors. 23 people have been trapped. Most of them killed were hotel guests. Cuba's foreign minister, Bruno Rodriguez, is blaming social media activists in the U.S. for a campaign that led to Sunday's large anti-government march in Havana and smaller ones across the island. Thousands took to Cuba's capital city streets, clashing with police and several thousand pro-government supporters. One protester died while trying to overrun a police station on Sunday. That's according to the Ministry of Interior, informing through a written communique late Tuesday. The president of Guatemala has banned most protests for 2 weeks, arguing that they've been spreading the coronavirus. President Alejandro Giammattei's cabinet approved the decree Tuesday, and it will go into effect Wednesday. Protesters have demanded his resignation in recent weeks, saying the government mismanaged the coronavirus pandemic and botched efforts to get vaccines. There have been delays in shipments of Russia's Sputnik vaccine, even though Guatemala paid half up front. It is the latest of more than a dozen decrees he has issued to temporarily limit constitutional rights. And even the vice president, Guillermo Castillo, says enough is enough. And recapping one of our top stories, an Iranian intelligence officer and three members of an Iranian intelligence network have now been charged in Manhattan, New York, with plotting to lure U.S. resident and human rights activists from New York City to Iran. More at VOAnews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 14, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The death toll in South Africa's protest has risen.
What has been happening in South Africa on the ground is that we've been seeing a spike in protests, which have degenerated into a looting spree.
The World Food Program calls for greater access to Ethiopia's war-torn Tigray province. A new study says internet restrictions are holding back Africa's economic growth. Gambia's High Court says the country's electoral commission violated the constitution. And will SADC meet its own timetable to deploy troops to Mozambique?
There's been a lot of shuffling in between the capitals around in the southern region. And what we know really is that Filipe Nyusi, the Mozambican president, has been a bit confused in terms of which military entity he can work with.
And arming communities with mobile technology to monitor deforestation. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The South African human rights lawyer says while members of the South African National Defense Force are taking every precaution to protect the rights of looters and peaceful protesters, there is a concern that the Defense Force is not trained in crowd management. Economic Freedom Fighter leader Julius Malema tweeted Tuesday that no member of the South African National Defense Force should be deployed to quell the ongoing arrest. The protest and subsequent looting began last Friday after former South African President Jacob Zuma was sentenced to 15 months for contempt of court. Reports on Tuesday said that the death toll had risen to 45. Stanley Malit Maja is a lawyer with the Southern African Human Rights Defenders Network. He says it appears the protest has degenerated into the issue of inequality in South Africa, particularly poverty among the blacks.
What has been happening in South Africa on the ground is that we've been seeing a spike in protests, which have degenerated into a looting spree and a lot of incidents of malicious damage to property.
This protest is happening because former President Jacob Zuma was sentenced. What do the protesters say? Do they believe that he should not have been sent to jail?
Although there's a of people who are for the rule of law and say he's in prison or in contempt of a court. Now, what we have, it is now an unrest about the deep inequalities in South Africa, particularly poverty amongst the black people.
Should we expect more protests on Wednesday?
I mean, from what we've been getting from our media sources is that the protesters said they will not stop protesting. But also, on the other hand, our government has sought the assistance of the South African National Defense Force to assist our South African police services to enforce the law and ensure that the looting sprees come to a cul-de-sac. So at this moment, really, a lot of shopping centers in around the country have been beat up in terms of security, although we have seen scores and scores of damages, especially in the province of Gauteng and the province of KwaZulu-Natal.
I read a tweet by Mr. Malema of the Economic Freedom Fighters, and he says that no member of the South African Defense Forces should be deployed to quell the ongoing unrest. But some would say that what about the looting that is taking place in the streets?
From a human rights law perspective, right, the concern is that our South African National Defense Force are not trained to deal with issues of crowd management. So the worry is that what happens in a situation where our South African National Defense Force members become overhanded and in the process of trying to assist the police to carry out their duties, then they end up transgressing some of the fundamental constitutional rights that we have in our constitution, such as right to be free from inhumane and degrading punishment. So I think the tweet was a caution to that, to say we are not confident that our South African National Defence Force are properly trained to deal with issues of crowd management. So I don't know if you have seen like the images and you have seen the pictures. You would have seen that with the police and the municipal police force, what they've been using to disperse the crowds, it's some of the less lethal force, which is, you know, lawful, such as the use of tear gas canisters and such as the use of rubber bullets to disperse the crowd. But if you've seen the images of the South African National Defence Force, all of them were equipped with, I'm not really a gun specialist, but from prima facie view, I can just say AK-47s, and all of them look like they loaded with live ammunition.
Stanley Malimanja is a human rights lawyer with the Southern African Human Rights Defenders Network. You are speaking with us from Johannesburg. Will the Southern African Development Community, SADC, meet its own timetable to deploy troops to Mozambique's troubled Cabo Delgado province by tomorrow, July 15? The regional group agreed last month to intervene in Cabo Delgado to quell Islamic insurgency there. But the early arrival of about 1,000 Rwandan troops appears to be causing friction between Mozambican President Filipe Nyusi and other powerful SADC member countries. Rejoice Ngwenya is a Zimbabwean political analyst.
There's been a lot of shuffling in between the capitals around in the southern region, you know, the organ for peace and politics. And what we know really is that Filipe Nyusi, the Mozambican president, has been a bit confused in terms of which military entity he can work with, because obviously there is a bit of reluctance for a kind of SADC force. For some reason, we don't know why, but we heard that, you know, a meeting between the Rwandan president and the French president yielded some kind of movement of Rwandan troops. These are purely press reports, but it's very clear that Filipe Nyusi has zeroed in on Zimbabwe and Rwanda as some kind of military intervention force.
I read an article. I saw that Rwanda is already or has already sent troops. If that is the case, is the deployment of Rwandan troops the same as SADC troop deployment?
Well, look, as far as I'm concerned, really, my initial analysis, James, is that Rwanda really has never played a big role in the affairs of SADC. It's actually very strange why that decision has been made. But, you know, when you are deploying troops in a region, one needs to be very cautious about the cultural and the behavioral, characters around in that region. My humble understanding really is that I think there's been a lot of political shuffling and, dilly-dallying. Look, SADC is our region, and if the SADC, the regional presidents, have decided to go for that, it would be a bit like sending Zimbabwean troops to handle the Nigerian problem. But, I've met a lot of political analysts who are even already concerned about the rate at which SADC is dragging its feet. And SADC is not in a good space, James. There's a few problems in Swaziland. South Africa is unstable. So we needed a decisive intervention system. But it seems, Filipe Nyusi has opted for Rwanda.
Rejoice, as you know, the situation in Mozambique's Cabo Delgado region has been terrible in terms of the human rights situation. I wonder, how is it this coming SADC deployment being viewed by the government of Mozambique and or by the opposition in Mozambique?
We have no information on the comments that are being made by the citizens of Mozambique. What we know really is that region is under distress. And I suppose perhaps the citizens of Cabo Delgado will want anybody to intervene and reestablish and stabilize their lives. But I can tell you from the ground in Zimbabwe, there is a lot of doubt whether the Rwandans can be able to tackle this issue, because Zimbabweans tend to be more adept at handling such situations. I suppose maybe Rwanda is that experience in the Goma region.
That was Rejoice Ngwenya, a Zimbabwean political analyst. He was speaking with us from the capital, Harare. The World Food Program is calling for greater access to Ethiopia's war-torn northern province of Tigray, noting that the convoy of food that reached the capital Mekelle on Monday is not enough to meet growing needs. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The convoy of 50 trucks laden with 900 tons of food and other emergency supplies is the first to reach Tigray since the World Food Program restarted its humanitarian operation there nearly 2 weeks ago. The WFP says the food commodities transported to the region are enough to feed 200,000 people for a week. Agency spokesman Thompson Fury says that is not enough. He says the amount delivered falls far short for the nearly 4 million people who need emergency food aid in Tigray.
The food stocks and other emergency items just delivered and badly needed by the communities in Tigray will run out. And we need regular and fast deliveries into the region. We need 100 trucks to be moving in on any given day for half the time if we are to reverse the catastrophic humanitarian situation in the region.
The latest UN food assessment finds more than 400,000 people in Tigray are starving, and another 1.8 million are on the verge of famine. Ethiopian government troops invaded the province November 4th in response to an attack on one of its military bases by the Tigray People's Liberation Front. The federal government declared a unilateral ceasefire June 28th. Tigrayan forces quickly seized control of Mekelle soon after. Fury says the trucks must start moving toward Tigray immediately, given the long, difficult journey ahead. He says it takes 4 days to travel just 445 kilometers from the town of Semera to Mekelle.
WFP is extremely concerned with the pace of the response and capacity, as both food and fuel stocks are very low and may impact our ability to mount an effective response. At this rate, WFP cannot hope to scale up to reach over 2 million people in need of food assistance in Tigray.
The WFP is calling for greater access to Tigray and for more money. The UN Food Agency says it needs $176 million to continue to scale up its life-saving support to people in Tigray until the end of the year. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, July 14. A report by a nonprofit group says Africa needs to increase internet access to boost its economies, especially in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. The advocacy group found that while Africa's locally routed online traffic has increased, only one in five Africans has internet access. As Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi, high taxes and frequent internet shutdowns by some African governments have also discouraged online trade.
The Internet Society Group says in a report this month, Africa's Internet Exchange Points, or IXPs, have increased from 19 to 46 in under 8 years. Six countries have more than one IXP. An IXP is where multiple networks and service providers exchange internet traffic. The increase is significant because a decade ago, most African countries routed their online traffic outside the continent. Dawit Bekele is the Africa Regional Vice President for the Internet Society, a global non-profit organization that promotes the development and use of the internet. He says Africa having its own IXPs improves internet performance for users on the continent.
By developing internet exchange points within Africa, we have limited this kind of unnecessary travel of the internet traffic outside of Africa to come back to Africa, which has considerable advantage in improving the user experience, be it with the speed of connectivity or even the cost of connectivity.
The Washington-based group says its goal is to eventually have 80% of internet traffic in Africa be exchanged locally. Michael Nyi Tejeka, an information technology expert, says public demand has forced African governments to improve internet access.
We can't run away from the youth population. there are quite a number of young people, and therefore their affinity or drive for technology and use of internet is way higher than, let's say, our parents, and they would find it, they're more comfortable using technology than anything else. Finally, the other aspect that I think is quite critical is the access to technology, mobile devices, is definitely a big driver. We see quite a number of relatively cheap, smart or internet-enabled phones in our market. And that has had a massive effect on how many people can access the internet.
In a 2020 study, the International Foundation Corporation said internet users could add $180 billion to Africa's economies. However, some governments have taken steps to control digital communication by shutting down social media platforms and imposing a high tax on internet use. Omoniyi Kolande is the CEO of Cedibit, a Nigerian company that offers payment processing services to businesses. He says that government control of the internet will drive businesses backward.
It has been a way where we'll be driven backward instead of moving forward, right? We are supposed to actually encourage access. We're supposed to encourage collaboration and free access for interactions for solutions, right? Because if businesses are to put their product on platform, right, as long as those platforms are being put down or disconnected, right, I think there's some loss of revenue at that point, right? And for payment gateway, we're already losing revenue as far as those businesses does not exist to achieve just the purpose of what they should achieve.
The United Nations Economic Commission for Africa notes that only 20% of the continent's population has access to the internet. The Internet Society Group is urging African governments to expand internet infrastructure to rural areas where most of the population lives so that they can benefit from it. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Gambia's High Court said Tuesday that the country's Independent Electoral Commission violated the constitution when it allowed the mayor of the capital, Banjul, to sign documentation for voters' cards to be issued to applicants. The case was brought by a local Banjul ward councillor and two civil society groups, Gambia Center for Research and Democracy and Gambia Participates. Pandere Umbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
The High Court verdict followed a lawsuit questioning the legality of the mayor's move to sign documentation on behalf of applicants seeking voters' cards. Many applicants were issued the cards following the mayor's signed declarations indicating that those seeking the cards were born in Banjul. But the plaintiffs argued that the mayor's action was unconstitutional. They say that under Gambian law, only local government leaders, such as chiefs and alcaldes, are empowered to vouch on behalf of voters' card applicants. The court on Tuesday upheld the plaintiffs' arguments and ruled in their favor. It says the mayor's action was indeed unconstitutional. Alhaji Abdullahi Fati is the lawyer for the plaintiffs.
This is great. This is great for the rule of law. This is great for our jurisprudence. This is great for demonstrating the independence of the judiciary. I think it's a fantastic outcome.
The Independent Electoral Commission, or IEC, has just concluded its voter registration drive. About 1 million people have been registered to vote in the upcoming December 4th presidential elections.
So basically what we were seeking before the court is declaration. Firstly, that the issuing of attestations by the mayor of Banjul contravened the relevant section of the Election Act, so the section prescribing qualifications for registration. A forward declaration that the IEC conferring that power on the office of the mayor to exercise those attestation functions also contravened.
According to lawyer Fati, even though the court has ruled in his client's favor, it also said it lacks jurisdiction to cancel voters' cards that have already been issued.
We also asked the court, as consequential orders, to cancel all voter cards issued as a result of the attestation by the mayor. But the court said it lacked the power, it lacked the jurisdiction to do so, because according to the Elections Act, well, in this instance, only the revising court had such power. So if my client still wanted the cancellation of those cards, then they'll have to go to the revising court.
Notwithstanding, Fati argues that the court judgment was a major victory for Gambia's pro-democracy activists. He knows that under any democratic dispensation, public officials should be held accountable.
The primary issue here is the declaration itself. It is important that when citizens feel aggrieved by the public functions or in the exercise of public functions by public officials, that we simply go to court. We didn't enjoy these rights and privileges under Yahya Jammeh's dictatorship, but now we can. And I think this is fantastic for the rule of law, fantastic for the principle of separation of powers.
Under Gambian law, the defendants have the right to file an appeal. But for now, the court has ruled that the mayor and the IEC have acted outside the dictates of the law. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandering by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Communities in places like Liberia should be armed with technology that helps them monitor deforestation to improve forest management, says a new study by the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. A co-founder of the study, Darren Christensen, talked to Ricky Stryak about what kind of technology should be deployed and who should be using it to help decrease deforestation.
These are forests that are managed by community leaders who don't necessarily have a lot of accountability. These are elders, these are chiefs at various levels who are making these decisions often in ways that aren't necessarily checked or informed by their communities' needs or interests. And we thought there's a possibility here that these leaders are striking deals with chainsaw crews, timber crews, and cutting more forest than their constituents would like and not sharing the benefit. Both problems we thought could be addressed through not remote technology per se, but actually like a very human and simple technology, which was simply mobilizing a set of people within this community to go out, walk the forest, document use, and come back and report to their neighbors and other members of the community what they were seeing happen.
Can you give me some specifics about, you know, what does this look like? How are people documenting? What tools are they using?
What this looks like in practice is we had communities actually involving leadership nominate individuals to participate as monitors. We wanted these to be people that, you know, leadership had some faith in, so we did give them some say, but we also insisted that there be some representation. It was important to us that women, for example, were represented among monitors. We then trained them to use some very simple, both handwritten and sort of more mobile forms. So imagine them with a cell phone. It has GPS on it. They're walking through the forest. If they see, for example, the work of a chainsaw crew, they would be able to take a geo-coordinate. They would record some basic details about the scale of the activity, and they would take a picture. And then they would continue their walk. And then from that, they would sort of assemble a report that there was so much activity related to timber. There was so much activity related to small farms or larger commercial farms. We saw so many people who were engaged in mining. And then we had them come back to the community, compile that information. And then over the next month, they would ask the leadership of the community if they could convene a meeting or, in coordination with a town meeting that was already happened, present what they had found to the people in their village.
What kind of challenges are posed in this kind of arrangement when, as you mentioned earlier too, you know, it's often the elders of the village, and there is often a tradition of not questioning maybe the older people of the community?
One of the things is that the people who are being empowered as monitors are often coming from a set of households that are already in some ways connected to leadership or have some kind of status. I mean, one of the things that was a requirement of being a monitor, given the use of the mobile forms, is they had to have some basic literacy and numeracy. And so these are people within the computer community with a bit more education and a bit more standing. And that was intentional because we thought, you know, armed with information, those are going to be the sort of people who are going to have the power to stand up to elders or chiefs within the community and at least question or raise questions about the use of the community forest, and in particular, the ways in which benefits from that use are being distributed within the community.
That was Darren Christensen, a co-author of a recent study on the impact of arming communities with mobile technology to monitor forests. You are speaking to Ricky Stryer from the United States. And that's it for this Wednesday, July 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Tracy Carter, sitting in for Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington saying,